Good evening, little masters, and welcome to episode 223 of the Prancing Pony Podcast, where we're about to be in a fix, and no mistake.
Well, hang on. We're not heading down into Aemon Muil just yet. Folks, go ahead and pull up a bench in the common room. I'm Sean Marchese, the Lord of the Mark, and I'm here with the Man of the West, who might still be thinking in Elvish time after reading The Nature of Middle-earth, Alan Sisto.
Yeah, those are some serious grad-level math problems, Sean, but that's not the fix I was talking about. We're going to catch up to Frodo and Sam soon enough. But today, we're welcoming a few of our patrons to join us for our 16th quarterly Questions After Nightfall.
Oh, that's the fix you were talking about. Yeah.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
That fix we're in, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, for those of you joining us for the first time, welcome. Here at the Prancing Pony Podcast, we are reading and talking our way through Tolkien's stories of Middle-earth a few pages at a time.
And talking. But once a quarter, we take a break from our read-through and talking and welcome a few of our patrons to join us here in the common room and bring along some of their very best questions.
Now, we never have any idea what they're going to ask us, so, as always, Alan and I are going to be answering their questions as best we can with the resources available to us right here in our recording nooks.
That's right. Now, as with previous Questions After Nightfall episodes, aside from edits for nervous coughs or time spent flipping through pages while we look frantically for an answer, we're going to be presenting this as it was recorded live. So everything you hear in this show will have been recorded during this session.
And if you'd like to get in on the next one, go check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/prancingponypod. We record these Questions After Nightfall episodes every quarter, and we invite patrons at the Elrond's Honorarium tier and higher to join us.
That's just one of the many ways that we say thank you to our patrons, giving them the opportunity to join us on the show, make us laugh, make us think, and occasionally embarrass us in the best possible way.
Of course, always in the best possible way.
Yeah.
All right. So I think first up tonight, we have got Joe.
All right, Joe.
Howdy, all.
Howdy, Joe.
Howdy.
Where are you coming to us from tonight?
I am coming to you from the Gulf Coast of Texas.
All right.
All right.
The weather hasn't blown you away yet, then.
Not yet.
Good, good. We'll keep hoping it stays that way.
Yes, indeed.
What do you have for us?
So, y'all mentioned in your introduction the nature of Middle-earth, and I wanted to ask you sort of an open-ended question about the nature of Middle-earth.
Yeah.
Have you both read it? And if so, what is your favorite part? And if you haven't read the whole thing, what are you most looking forward to reading?
Well, goodness, I'll start with that. We, by the time this episode releases, you'll all know that we interviewed Carl Hostetter for the first episode of this season.
Yep.
And we were excited to have that opportunity. He did send us review copies of the book beforehand, but I have to tell you, mine didn't arrive in time. I actually didn't get it until after we'd conducted the interview. I believe it arrived when I was at Oxenmoot, so I haven't had a chance to read the whole thing. I have read bits, significant bits, but I haven't read the whole thing. I just love all this sort of metaphysical stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The thought process behind, well, really everything. I love the philosophical and even theological things that Carl's been talking about in this book. I think it's going to be fantastic. I'm excited to dive deep into that and really get insight into Tolkien's own perspectives on these things. That's what I'm most interested in. Rather than facts and clearing up any questions, it's that metaphysical stuff.
Yeah, I agree. So I also got my review copy a little bit late. So I'm still reading it, actually, and I haven't gotten that far into it yet just because, well, I've been getting ready for this new season.
Yeah, I was going to say, we've got season 6 to get ready for, right?
But I can tell you that I'm still in the time and aging section, which is the beginning, and I got to tell you guys, there's a lot of math in it for me.
Oh, like, there is a lot. Just, yeah.
It's super cool, and I know, like, I know, Joe, like, this, I mean, this is literally, you know, what you do, so I know you're excited about all that stuff, but yeah, it's a lot for me, and it's super cool, but it does kind of make my head spin a little bit. I am also really excited for the metaphysical stuff. The whole second section of the book, which I have here in front of me, is called Body, Mind, and Spirit, is where Tolkien is getting into a lot of things about, you know, Elvish biology and body, mind, and spirit, literally, you know, all three of those things.
Yeah.
There is a reprint of Osanwe Kenta in there, as well as some other stuff that's appeared in Vinyar Tengwar.
Oh, I can't wait to get to that.
And there's some other stuff that looks like it's really elaborating on some of the stuff we've seen in Morgoth's Ring, like Finwë and Miriel, the statue to Finwë and Miriel, rather, and stuff like that. So I'm really excited about that. The other thing, I'm not sure exactly where it is in the book, but when we talked to Carl a couple of weeks ago, which will have been a couple of weeks ago in podcast time when people are listening to this as well, he talked to us about some of Tolkien's kind of appropriation and incorporation of like Aristotelian metaphysics into the legendarium. And so that's the stuff that's right up my alley. You know, when you're talking about ancient Greek philosophers being barred by Tolkien, that is exactly the kind of stuff that I'm here for. So I am super excited for that. But yeah, I'm really just getting started in the book, so I can't really even say what my favorite part is just yet.
And also some Thomistic metaphysics as well. St. Thomas of Aquinas. So
Yeah. Because I mean, that he picked up where Aristotle left off.
Exactly. And I love that. I can't wait to dive into that. My pre-ordered book didn't arrive until after my review copy showed up. So,
oh really?
Sadly, I didn't even get a head start on that.
Later.
I mean, I got back from Oxymoot and there was my review copy. And then 2 days later, my pre-ordered copy showed up. So,
yeah.
And eventually my special edition will show up as well.
Yeah. But seriously, it is an amazing book. If people have not got it yet, seriously, go pick up a copy because it is, it's right there in line with everything that Christopher Tolkien was doing in History of Middle Earth. And if you haven't heard that episode yet where we talked to Carl, well, go listen to it.
Oh, please do. Yeah.
I mean, he did all of this stuff with Christopher's explicit approval and at least, you know, up until the point when Christopher passed, of course.
Well, right. But, of course. He did get to read a rough draft of the book, though.
He did, and he worked closely with Christopher while he could, and so it's very much in the spirit of that. It's almost like an unofficial, you know, 13th volume or 14th volume if you count John Ratliff's History of the Hobbit.
Or 15th volume if you count The Index.
Right.
Or 16th volume if you count Unfinished Tales, as many do.
There's so many ways to count it. It's an official. It's like an unofficial extra volume of History
of the Hobbit.
It really is. So totally belongs on your bookshelf. And it's amazing. Yeah,
it does. And just like the History of Middle Earth volumes, you can bounce around it. If the math throws you off, just go to another section. You know, you don't have to read A before B before C before D. You can read the topics that interest you. And I highly recommend doing that if you know, rather than getting stuck someplace where you just can't get past it.
I'm going to be stubborn and I'm going to try and read it straight through. But you're absolutely right. If the math does get to be too much for me, well, first of all, I'll
just reach out to Joe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if he can't answer the question, then I'll just go ahead and skip ahead to something.
Yeah. Yeah. Good stuff.
All right. Thank you very much, Joe. Great question.
Mm-hmm.
And I am going to move on to our second questioner of the day.
All right.
And that is Jim.
Jim, I am terrified of your puns. I live in fear of your puns. Go ahead. Lay it on me.
He's had a whole hiatus to think of some new ones, too.
I know.
Well, not only that, but you guys also forgot to send me an email for the last QAN, and I felt like maybe it was either the puns or maybe you didn't consider my opinion to be worthwhile anymore. Much like Gimli felt when his father Glowin chased him out of the mine. Young Gimli was always coming up with great ideas, and Glowin just thought he was just getting in the way, get out of the way, let me do my work. So one day he came in, he had a lodestone, and he said, "Look, Dad, it points in the direction of the iron." And Glowin smacked his head, and he said, "Gimli, for the last time, get out here with ideas. This is a copper mine. It's not attracted to copper, it's attracted to iron." So Gimli just slunk off and went back to Orcslaying class.
Sure.
Glowin said, that's a load off my mind.
Oh. Oh. No.
Oh, Jim.
No, this is not okay.
Jim.
No.
Jim.
I want to inflict on you the part where Beaufort breaks through an adjoining wall and he says, hey, get out of here. This is a load off my mind.
Mm.
Oh,
man.
Oh.
Jim, this is why we're going to forget to send you the email next time, too.
Yeah. I'm not sure that forget is the right word, actually.
Yeah.
That suggests it was unintentional.
Well, if you don't forget, then at least I hope you forgive.
Absolutely. Always. Absolutely.
I need a lot of forgiveness on this show. But anyway, I wanted to ask a question. I bumped into this in reading some of the other material. I'm wondering, is Isildur the hero of the age who slew the most powerful being in Middle Earth at the end of the Second Age, or was he a corpse robber? Because I've seen different accounts. I had always thought, basically, Sauron kills Elendil, Sauron and breaks the sword, Sauron kills Gil-galad, and then Isildur, in desperation, grabs the hilt shard and whacks off the ring, and then Sauron decides to depart from this world. And there are like three different accounts in here, two in the Fellowship of the Ring, and the most definitive one seems to be in
Oh, Chapada, where the ring breaks right into the Shire.
And in that one, you'll see that it says that Sauron was thrown down and Isildur cut off the ring with the Shard of Narsil. Then Sauron, for that time, was vanquished and he forsook his body and his spirit fled away to waste places. Yeah. So it seems to me like he's still alive. Isildur cuts the ring. Then he says, okay, now I'm getting out of here. But I've seen other authorities who seem to think that it's the other way around, that he was already dead. And Isildur said, hey, nice ring, and chopped it off. So what's your opinion on that?
All right. So was Sauron dead? Yeah. Let's take a look.
Yeah. My recollection from the book, and maybe you can look this up while I'm talking.
Of course
it through,
I will,
Alan.
But hint, hint, wink, wink.
My recollection from the book is that it is different from the film. In the film, we have this dramatic moment where Isildur, you know, hacks at the hand of Sauron and cuts a couple of fingers off, I think, including the one holding the ring. Wearing the ring, I should say. But in the book, as I recall, we're told that Elendil and Gil-galad threw down Sauron, which tells me that Sauron is already dead.
Yes, that is correct.
And Isildur just cut the ring from the finger of Sauron's, not really a corpse because he's not really an incarnate, but you know what I mean.
And that's the thing. You know, he's dead in that sense. Let's go ahead and read that text from that, talking about the siege of Barad-dûr. That they laid siege to it for 7 years and suffered grievous loss by fire and by the darts and bolts of the enemy. And Sauron sent many sorties against them. There in the valley of Gorgoroth, Anarion, son of Elendil, was slain and many others. But at the last, the siege was so strait that Sauron himself came forth. And he wrestled with Gil-galad and Elendil, and they both were slain, and the sword of Elendil broke under him as he fell. But Sauron also was thrown down, and with the hilt shard of Narsil, Isildur cut the ruling ring from the hand of Sauron and took it for his own. Then Sauron was for that time vanquished, and he forsook his body, and his spirit fled far away and hid in waste places, and he took no visible shape again for many long years. To me, what I'm seeing here, of course, he's not dead. He's only mostly dead. I mean, he's a Maia, so he's not going to die in the way that Gil-galad and Elendil did, where, truly they're dead. In this case, he's thrown down and is now vulnerable. In a way, Sean, I actually see this as similar to the way the Witch King is defeated. It took both Merry and Eowyn. And you had to make the Witch King vulnerable with the stab in the back of the knee before Eowyn could then do what she did. Well, here, Sauron had to be thrown down by Gil-galad and Elendil before Isildur could then take the ring off the vulnerable finger. And that is what then vanquished him. So yeah, taking the ring is what removed so much of Sauron's power, and he was defeated as a result. And that's why he left his body. You know, he abandoned that clothing, right? The garment that he had taken, and then eventually would take shape again later on. But that's how we read it.
That's an interesting point. And actually, the comparison to Eowyn and Merry is a good one. I mean, the one big difference that I'll call out before somebody shouting at their phone while listening to this is that at the Last Alliance, Sauron is actually thrown down and he's incapacitated in some way.
Yeah.
How long, we don't know. How long would he have lain there before getting up? We don't know. But he was incapacitated and Isildur cut the ring from his finger.
Right.
Whereas Eowyn and Merry, the Witch King was still on his feet, was still fighting. Yeah. I mean, obviously he was taken aback when he was hamstrung. But
that'll do it every time.
But he was still on his foot. He was still an active combatant.
Oh, yeah. That is a huge difference. My point just being that he became vulnerable.
I agree 100% with your comparison. And I think that's a good way to break it down, which is that Elendil and Gil-galad overthrew him. That's the word that we're given by Tolkien. He was overthrown. He wasn't slain. He was overthrown. Right. And while incapacitated, Isildur was able to cut the ring from his finger. And that is what sealed his defeat at that point.
That's correct. And both versions agree. You know, I read the version from Otrapada, from Of the Rings of Power in the Third Age, which is at the end of the Silmarillion volume. And in the Council of Elrond, we read the word that you just gave, which was overthrown. You know, and Elrond's telling the story, and he says, I beheld the last combat on the slopes of Orodruin, where Gil-galad died, and Elendil fell, and Narsil broke beneath him, but Sauron himself was overthrown. And Isildur cut the ring from his hand with the hilt shard of his father's sword and took it for his own. So one, he's overthrown, and the other, he's thrown down. It's really much the same thing.
Yeah, And overthrown is the word that Gandalf uses well. He says, overthrew Sauron. Gil-galad and Elendil overthrew Sauron. But again, he doesn't say that they killed him, doesn't say that they slew him. And in fact, he doesn't say that Sauron was vanquished until after Isildur cut the ring off of his finger.
Yeah, his vanquishing didn't take place, according to Gandalf, until Isildur took the ring, cut the ring from Sauron's hand.
I think that's very telling, and I think that supports your theory that it's Elendil and Gil-galad who won the fight, but then Isildur, you know, kind of took care of the wounded on the battlefield, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly. He just runs a sword through him, you know. I mean, he's wounded, and, you know, maybe he gets back up, maybe he doesn't, but by taking the ring, you certainly prevent that.
Right.
Jim, you still have something to say on that.
Oh, I'm sorry. I raised my hand to say vanquished and overthrown from Shadow of the Past.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're right. Both overthrown and vanquished. Yeah.
I think one thing I want to say about this is probably the reason that there's a fair bit of argument over this on the internet is, well, because it's the internet.
Well,
but
yeah.
Also
famous for arguments. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But I also think that, again, the movies have kind of gotten into the conversation so much.
Yeah.
And we see Isildur as more of a villain in the movies.
We see that scene where he's holding the ring and he turned back to Elrond and, you know, like, no, I'm not going to do this.
Right. And so I think that there's a strong thread of people wanting to kind of, you know, kind of point out Isildur's flaws because he is a very flawed character and we tend to see him as a villain from the movies. But and one way to kind of point out his flaws is to diminish the role he played at the Last Alliance by saying, oh, no, he's just a grave robber. He just went and cut the jewelry off the corpse, you know.
But as we have discussed, he's hardly a villain. You know, we talk about the disaster of the Gladden Fields and the fact that he knew the ring needs to go to Galadriel. And I'm going to make this journey. And of course, it ends up being fatal.
He made a mistake, but he repented of it.
Exactly. Exactly. Just like Boromir.
Yeah.
So that was a fun question. I really enjoyed digging into that and kind of maybe dispelling some of the persistent movie myths.
Yeah. And that's an interesting way in which the movies have colored our perception of the book, because simultaneously we've got this idea of Isildur as a villain. And yet at the same time, the movies are responsible for putting it in people's heads that Isildur killed Sauron as well, because we see that dramatic scene I was just talking about. So
I'm hoping that in the Amazon adaptation, we eventually, because it'll happen towards the end of the series, I want to see Isildur get the sapling in Numenor before the end. Oh, that's such a powerful moment.
That would be super cool. I really would like to see that, because that is one of his best hero moments.
Oh, total heroic moment. Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. Well, who do we have up next, Sean?
All right. Next up, we've got Diane.
Diane, welcome.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing all right.
Doing great. Welcome to the PPP.
I'm doing good. I'm here in Philadelphia. And
okay.
I've been thinking a lot about the Valar and kind of like their married life.
Oh, okay.
Because, you know, Iluvatar kind of makes it, when the Valar come in, you know, we have Manwë and Varda are already married and Ellie and Ivana are married. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Tulkas married.
Yes, he does.
Yeah, that's, and he's, you know, weary and content.
Mm-hmm.
But what about, you know, their daily life? Like, does Ivana get mad because Aoi leaves beard hair in the sink? Does Varda ask Manwë, does this robe make my butt look big? I mean, like,
love
what are
this.
They doing every day?
Oh, my goodness. Oh, fun speculation. I think Ivana gets mad at Aoi because he leaves dwarves in the sink.
Yeah, exactly.
Rather than beard hair. But yeah, boy, that is a fun question.
I think she's more upset that he leaves dwarves in the forest, but you know.
Dwarves in the forest rather than beard hair in the sink. That is hilarious. And well, I keep thinking of Varda just rolling her eyes at the fact that every outfit in Manwë's closet is blue. You
know? What should I wear to work today, honey? I don't know. How about the blue one?
With the blue tie. Yeah, and the blue sport coat. Yeah.
Should I go for more of an azure or a cerulean? I don't know, honey. They're all blue.
Sapphire works too.
They all look blue to me.
Oh, what is the name of that hyper intelligent shade of blue in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy?
Oh, the Hulu.
That's the one. Right? That's the one. The hyper intelligent shade of blue. I love that. Great stuff.
Yep.
There's a crossover for you.
I'm sorry. I was wrong. It's the Hulu, I believe. I put one extra Hulu in there.
That does sound kind of fun, doesn't it? But yeah, it's the Hulu. Yeah.
Hulu.
Good stuff, man. I don't know. Is there any information perhaps in the Nature of Middle-earth that would give us some insight into the married life of the Valar? I don't know. That's the only place I can think of where stuff hasn't already been published, because there's really nothing on it other than that.
No, I haven't come across anything in Nature of Middle-earth yet, but I'm still just starting it.
That's true.
I think we need to look to the works we already have to see.
Yeah, I think so too.
The fact that Yavanna and Aule bicker like an old married couple.
They kind of do.
They argue about, you know, him staying up late working in the workshop and, you know, making dwarves and stuff without anybody's permission. Oh, you didn't even tell me you were going to make the dwarves. Thanks a lot.
Seriously, like, you could have told the rest of, right. You know, you don't have to tell the rest of the Valar, but you could have told me.
You should have
wife.
Told me. I'm your wife.
Yeah.
We know that Tulkas and Nessa.
Yeah, we know.
Do things that married couples do.
We do.
And we know that Manwë and Varda have very much a complementary relationship as husband and wife. We know that, you know, with Varda beside him, Manwë is better at what he does, which sounds to me very much like the idea of behind every great man is a great woman.
Yeah.
He can see further when she's standing beside him, right, or something to that effect. To me, that suggests that Tolkien thought of the Valar as very much like real world married couples. He's showing us different types of married relationships.
Yes.
Manwë and Varda are the couple who are a partnership. They work really well together. Mm-hmm. They do everything together.
They're definitely the power couple for sure.
Definitely the power couple, and they make each other better.
Yes.
Yavanna and Aule, they love each other. They're great, but they each do their own thing.
Yeah, they do.
Opposites attract with Yavanna and Aule.
Mm-hmm.
And Tulkas and Nessa, they're like the newlyweds.
Yeah.
They're, you know. And I'm kind of oversimplifying that one because
a little bit.
We're only told that they did that one time.
Well, but, yeah. You know. And we're not even told that explicitly. We're just sort of implied.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. 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 But no, I think that Tolkien was really trying to make the Valar as much like a real world married couple.
Yeah.
To make them relatable, mm-hmm. even though they're little g gods, but just to make them real.
I think maybe specifically because of that, maybe to kind of point out that little g god nature.
That makes them different from a capital G almighty god.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think you're right.
To make them more human.
Yeah, exactly. They're finite beings, and so they have counterparts.
Yeah.
And I think that if they're like us in all those ways, yeah, they probably argue about the same things
of
we
course.
Do.
We see that they make mistakes, right? I mean, I think we all know that the Valar have made mistakes, whether we talk about the mistake of inviting the Eldar to come over in the first place, or the mistake kind of trying to encourage them to stay there, or the mistake of allowing Feanor to leave instead of stopping him, or the mistake of not inviting the men. I mean, there's all sorts of things that we can second guess the Valar on. And the reality is they are flawed. They are created.
They are imperfect. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. They are fallible. They are like us in a lot of ways.
They really are.
And because of that, I have to think that their day-to-day life is a lot like ours. Probably bigger problems.
Oh, yeah, certainly. I hope so. I'm pretty sure that Manwë is not trying to figure out whether or not he needs to replace his garbage disposal.
Right.
You know?
Right.
I don't think he has a honey-do list, but I don't know. Maybe he does. I'm pretty sure Aule does.
And when the average guy's brother comes to stay with the family for a little while, you're not worried about him knocking over the lamps.
No, that's true. That is brilliant.
It's kind of horrible, but thank you.
Is, yeah.
So yeah, I think they're probably bigger problems, but similar problems for sure.
Yeah, I think so. That sure would be interesting to learn more about Tolkien's insight on that.
I think so.
Yeah.
What do you think, Diane? Did we answer the question?
Yeah, I think it did. I like that. Yeah, because I don't really see them as, how could you be completely godlike and be married? It just didn't make a lot of sense to me.
Right.
Right, yeah.
I mean, the idea certainly of the monotheistic God is that he's, you know, he has everything he needs in and of himself.
Exactly.
He doesn't need
anything
to complete himself. And certainly these little g gods do.
Yeah. And Tolkien is calling upon Greek mythology and Norse mythology with, you know, these finite, imperfect, immortal beings with godlike powers, yes, but they are not capital G God.
No, with almost godlike powers, right? I mean, we talked about how they are not fully omniscient, and they're certainly not fully omnipotent.
That's true, yeah.
So
godlike in the little G sense, you know?
Exactly, exactly. Like you said, out of the mythologies, whether it's classic mythology or Norse mythology, they definitely draw some inspiration from those.
And I think we tend to see that in those mythologies, certainly in Norse mythology,
oh, yeah,
that that the gods have the same kind of problems that we do.
Oh, very much. Their everyday life is
very much like ours.
Yeah. So. But like you said, on a bigger scale.
Yeah.
Agreed. That was a fun question.
It was. Thank you, Diane.
Yeah. Oh, I hope we have some more ones like that. Who's up next, Sean? No pressure on whoever that is, I'm afraid.
Next up is Lori, and I know she's going to do great. Lori, what have you got for us?
Oh, of course you will. Lori, welcome.
Yeah, I feel no pressure. It's
none
fine.
At all.
Good.
First off, congratulations on season 6. This is amazing and wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
We are happy to be here.
Yeah, I am so excited to be here. I haven't been able to be on a Questions After Nightfall in a while. Yeah. So I'm super, super happy.
It's good to have you.
Well, we're glad you're here.
Thank you. So I just finished another reading of The Lord of the Rings. We all do this, right? We read the book at least once a year because we're cool like that.
That's right.
That's right. And every time I read it, like probably everybody else who's in the room tonight, I find something new. And this time when I went through, for example, I really keyed in on Baragond, and I don't know why I'd never, like he was never really a big character for me in previous readings, but this time I just realized how much knowledge he has and how noble he is. You know, really hit me, right? So I wanted to know from the two of you, after 223 Prancing Pony podcast episodes and 16 Questions After Nightfall and about 15 interviews by my count.
Oh, yeah.
And a Prancing Pony podcast moot and a celebrity shout out from Dominic Moynihan and Billy Boyd. What has surprised you that you've learned in the past 6 seasons about the Legendarium, that just one thing that had never hit you before, that wow. you've personally kind of gone, whoa, that's awesome and cool. I'd love to hear about that.
Wow.
Oh, my goodness. That is a really good question.
That is a great question and a hard question.
A very hard one, because we've learned a lot over these 6 years, haven't we?
Yeah, we have. You know, early on in the show, we were going through the Silmarillion, which is just a denser text. And even though it's one that we felt we knew well enough to use it as our starting,
we thought we could do this, season. Right?
And I think we did a good job with it. But I think we were also still learning a lot quickly then. So it's like we're learning something new all the time.
All the time.
And we're still learning things new all the time. But we're also in Lord of the Rings now, which is a work that we know that much better.
Yeah. We're much more familiar with the story.
Yeah. And so when we have those like big eureka moments of like, oh my gosh, I never noticed that before. It does kind of hit us, but they still happen so frequently. And I'm struggling here. I think
I can give you one, and it's actually directly connected to you.
Oh, okay.
You came up with this great idea in Shadow of the Past when Gandalf was talking about Gollum and Frodo talked about, you know, how he deserved to die, and Gandalf's famous line about deserve death, you know, who are you to say these things, right? And, you know, I dare say he does.
Mm-hmm.
And you talked about that being because he was descended from men, he deserved death, not as a penalty, but as a reward.
As the gift of Iluvatar, yeah.
And wow, that was super, super insightful. And is something that I'd never even considered. And I have to say it resonates. And that's something new that I learned as we were reading through. So I'll start with that one.
Wow. Well, thank you for that. That's
You're welcome.
That's wonderful to hear. I actually have heard that feedback from a few people, and I'm pleased that I was able to point people to that. It's something that I think I picked up on either just in the moment when we were in the booth or maybe like, you know, earlier that day when I was looking over my notes. You know,
those are some of our best moments, the ones where we get that insight as we're in the booth. Yeah.
The one that's coming to mind for me right now is a more recent one. It's just from the last season, in fact. And it's the whole thing about the Ents and the Entwives.
Oh, yeah.
And the idea that those two were just kind of incompatible by the time the Entwives left. And I think it really changes the whole tone of Treebeard's pining. Yes, I went there.
Oh, no, you did not just say that.
I did.
Wow. Wow.
Treebeard's pining for the Fjords. No, for the Entwives. Because You spend all the time.
I wouldn't go there. I would leave that alone.
You would not, right? You would not. Yeah. Let's get back on topic and not branch off into a digression. Come on now.
Oh.
What was I talking about?
I did it. Woohoo! I threw him off.
Yeah, it was. You spend all that time when Treebeard is talking to Merry and Pippin about the Antwives, and you think, oh yeah. Man, it's so sad that they're lost. It would be so wonderful if they were reunited. And reading through it again, going through it for the show, we hit on this realization that, like, no, actually, they were so incompatible by the time the Antwives left that even if they were reunited, there is nothing there anymore.
If they were reunited, it wouldn't feel so good.
No,
it wouldn't. That's good. Yeah. I remember thinking that same thing a little bit. Yeah.
That's my favorite one from recently, because honestly, I will be totally honest. I've always liked the Ents. I've always thought Treebeard was cool. They are iconic. Yeah. It's part of Middle-earth. It's never really been one of my favorite aspects of the story or of the world.
The story comes to a pretty much grinding halt at that point.
It does. A creaking,
woody halt.
And in fact, I can tell you that that's the place where my wife, who's tried to read Lord of the Rings a couple of times, she gets to that point and she's like, oh man, it's just hard to go on past this point.
Yeah.
So I get that it's a hard part for a lot of people to read, and it's never been one of my favorites. It's good, but it's not one of my favorites. But now, after that realization, it's completely changed the whole Treebeard episode for me, and that's cool.
I love that. I love how sometimes learning a new thing like that transforms the way you read that character or that moment or that scene. Like our discussions about Tom Bombadil. You know, I had for years just been convinced, well, he must be an Ainu of some kind, because he must be. That's just the way it has to be.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't think outside of that taxonomy. But then as we talked about it, sort of the residue, if you will, of the creation of the earth.
It is
essentially this spirit, this sort of leftover from the creation of the earth. I thought, wow, that works. And it changes the way I view Tom.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I have a lot more of an interest in Tom too, after spending a lot of time thinking about him.
Yeah.
And again, it's just been one of those that I always thought Tom was entertaining. I never really missed him being cut out of the various adaptations.
No, of course not. Yeah.
Because like, how do you do it? And how do you do it?
How do you do justice to that?
Yeah.
I mean, and how do you create him in such a way that he's so mysterious that the idea that he's the byproduct of the music? I mean, it would have been nice, but.
It would have been. But I will admit that in prior readings, I was kind of like, all right, Tom Bombadil, let me get through this quickly. Let me get to the Prancing Pony. Let me get to Bree and all that stuff.
Yeah.
I'm a much bigger fan of Tom than I was before going through it with the podcast.
Yeah. Yeah, same here. And I've become, of course, a bigger fan of the poetry. That's not so much learning anything about the story, but that's just learning something about myself. That, you know, as we've done this read through, I've really come to love Tolkien's poetry a lot more, but especially, of course, his alliterative verse.
Yeah, just learning to appreciate another aspect of Tolkien, because there's just so much there.
So much.
Yeah.
Good question,
Laurie. Great question, Laurie. Thank you very much for that.
Yeah. Fun one to answer.
Yeah.
Well, now, before we get back to the questions, we want to take a quick break to make sure that you know that when you finish listening to this episode, well, the talk continues all night long at the Prancing Pony Podcast.
That's right. Our wonderful listener community keeps the conversation going in all of our social media spaces, from our common room on Facebook to our Reddit community, Twitter, and more.
Now, on Facebook, just look for the Prancing Pony Podcast. Be sure to follow the page, but also join the group for some great discussions.
You can find us on Reddit at r/PrancingPonyPod. And we're also at Prancing Pony Pod on Twitter and Instagram.
Now, folks, if you do enjoy the show, please consider supporting us by joining the Fellowship of the Podcast. When you do, you get a lot. You get an active Discord community that includes live episode recordings, postscripts, episodes without digital ads, free merchandise, and a lot more.
A lot more, actually.
Yes.
There's live Discord hangouts. There's a chance to be a part of episodes like this one, Questions After Nightfall.
That's right.
Or even join us as a guest in the North Wing. So check out patreon.com/prancingponypod to support the show and become part of the Fellowship of the Podcast.
And if you do enjoy the show, you can also help us out by giving us a rating and review over on Apple Podcasts. And please recommend us to your friends. That's what we really want.
Thank you.
Folks, it's time to go ahead and head back into the common room for some more questions. So, Sean, who do we have up next?
Okay, next up, we have got DeMay.
Hi, this is DeMay in Alaska. I have a speculation type question. I don't know if there's really a firm answer. And it is about hobbit feet. How big were hobbit feet? In the movies, they had really big feet, but they needed to fit over the actor's feet to protect them. So they were more like boots than just like a foot, like you put a sock on. So there you go.
That's going to be a fun one because it's one of my pet peeves, frankly. I love the brothers Hildebrandt. I love their art.
I know.
But I really, really wish they hadn't gone and done this funky thing that has no basis in the text.
Yeah. Well, and remember, we talked to Greg Hildebrandt about this when he was on the show.
Yeah, it was just artistic license.
Yeah, it was just artistic license. He said, you know, I was thinking of rabbit. You know, hobbit sounded kind of like rabbit. And to me, I just thought it would be a fun thing to do with their feet. And so.
Yeah, he talked about like giving Bilbo mutton chops. Right. I mean, it's just artistic license. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, let's go first to the prologue in The Lord of the Rings concerning hobbits. We do get a little bit about their feet. And here's what we read. They seldom wore shoes since their feet had tough, leathery soles and were clad in a thick, curling hair, much like the hair of their heads, which is commonly brown. Thus, the only craft little practiced among them was shoemaking. Do we get anything more on that? We do a little bit. When he gets into the different breeds of hobbits, the Harfoots are described as having nimble hands and feet, while the Stours, who were broader and heavier in build, their feet and hands were larger, but that's all we get. Then, of course, the Harfoots, which are the ones with the nimble hands and feet, are actually described as the most normal and representative variety and far the most numerous. So that's just about all we get. Did they have large feet? No evidence to suggest that they actually did. Seems like it was just artistic license on the part of the Hildebrandt brothers, and it has stuck, hasn't it?
It has. Now, the one exception is Odo Proudfoot.
Mm-hmm.
Remember Bilbo's birthday party?
Yeah.
Odo Proudfoot has his feet up on the table.
Yes.
And the text tells us that his name, of course, was Proudfoot. And well-merited. His feet were large, exceptionally furry, and both were on the table.
But large.
So he has large feet. And I wonder if that might be another thing that has contributed to the idea that, oh, well, all hobbits have large feet. But I think he's a Proudfoot. He is going to be named after this distinctive feature of his family. The Proudfeet are going to be called Proudfeet because they have exceptionally large and exceptionally furry feet.
And how large are they, though? I mean, it does say they're large, but again, you know, if I'm standing next to a basketball player, he's going to have very large feet in comparison to me. But they're not going to be the entire length of, you know, ankle to knee.
No.
You know, I mean, that's the thing. That's what it looks like in these illustrations, is that these feet are as large as the entire lower leg.
Yeah, exactly. Now, my point is that, you know, I think because Odo Proudfoot is described so prominently, I think that might feed the misconception a little bit. But you're right. He has large feet for a hobbit. Again, I have an uncle who has large feet for a human. It doesn't mean that he has rabbit-sized feet in proportion to his body. So
that's a very good point.
Yeah, I think that might be what kind of drives it. I think they probably have pretty normal-sized feet, honestly.
Tolkien did have a few illustrations, didn't he? Tolkien had, there's that one I'm thinking of that has, it's the view of Bag End. We're inside and we're looking out, and we can see Bilbo walking with his jacket, and I think he's smoking a pipe. I don't think he has big feet in that illustration. I'd have to see if I can track that down, but
I have to see if we can find that.
The Hall at Bag End, I think, is what it's called. So,
okay.
But I'm fairly sure he doesn't have big feet in that illustration. I don't know whether we see hobbit feet in any other picture that he drew, but it might be worth digging into the art of the Lord of the Rings or the art of the Hobbit to see.
Yeah, we may have to look into that.
Maybe the one at the Eagle's Eyrie.
I seem to remember, isn't there one illustration where a hobbit actually has shoes?
Oh, really? Well, that would be interesting.
I think so. I just can't. Okay, I've got it here in front of me. Uh-huh. And I want to say thanks to Jim, who posted a link in the chat to one of the pictures I was looking for. So the picture I'm thinking of is Bilbo Comes to the Huts of the Raft Elves. It's
Tolkien's
famous illustration that's on the cover of the Maker of Middle-earth book, where Bilbo is floating on the barrel down the river with all the other dwarves in their barrels around him. And in that picture, Bilbo is actually wearing boots. Very visible boots.
Okay, then.
I don't know if there are others.
Are they exceptionally large boots?
Well, they looked pretty normal size to me.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So again, going back to the question of feet, I don't think they're exceptionally large. I mean, we're told that hobbits were nimble of foot, aren't we? Their feet were neat and nimble.
Right.
Their hands and feet were neat and nimble, but their, you know, their feet were part of that. Can they have nimble feet if they're really big feet?
I don't know.
I don't know.
It also strikes me as being difficult to be stealthy if your feet are that large.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's just the hardfoots that we're looking at.
Yeah.
Just the hardfoots have neat and nimble feet. But still, I'm not seeing anything here to suggest that their feet were big.
I don't think they actually are, but certainly in popular culture, they are now. So
yeah,
it is what it is on that.
And I think DeMay raised an interesting point about the films, which is that the films kind of had to give them bigger feet because they're putting prosthetic feet on the actors. And so they had to be at least a little bit bigger.
Yeah.
But even in the movie, I mean, I remember them being somewhat big, but I don't remember them being like these massive things, were they?
No. And I'm looking at the drawing, the one that I mentioned earlier, of Bilbo in Bag End, and his feet are normally sized for sure.
Okay.
Tolkien's own illustration. I will say that the green door looks like it's about 12 feet tall in this particular picture. I don't know how he reaches the handle because it looks like it's significantly bigger than he is. But yeah, in Tolkien's own drawing, Bilbo has normal sized feet.
Yeah. And I'm looking at a couple of still shots from the Peter Jackson movies. And, you know, from Martin Freeman to Elijah Wood, yeah, they have sort of biggish feet, but they're not. They're not like ridiculous.
No.
They're not massively oversized feet. I think they're just, they had to make them a little bit bigger because they're putting something over the actor's actual foot. But,
well, that's true.
Yeah.
And adding all that fur.
Right.
Diane, it looks like you have something to follow up with on this. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember because I have the habit of reading many books at the same time. So I'm reading The Letters and I'm reading Morgus Ring and The Shaping of Middle Earth. But I recently read where Tolkien was talking about the issue of hobbit feet, and he was kind of annoyed with the idea of them being big because he was talking about how their feet are nimble, like their hands, you know, they're elegant.
Yeah.
So he specifically said in one of these things that I read that they do not have big feet. They have clever, elegant, you know, feet, just like their hands.
All right, Diane. Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's letter number 25, and it's to the editor of The Observer. And the text in Carpenter's collection tells us that in 1938, The Observer published a letter signed Habit, asking whether hobbits might have been suggested to Tolkien by some of Julian Huxley's work. And that the letter writer had said that a friend had told them that they remembered an old fairy tale called The Hobbit in a collection read about 1904, in which the creature was definitely frightening. Wanted to know more about kind of the inception or the idea of the hobbits. And Tolkien was very clear. He certainly has no recollection of any of the things this person talked about. And he says specifically that, nor indeed was he like a rabbit. He was a prosperous, well-fed young bachelor of independent means. Calling him a nasty little rabbit was a piece of vulgar trollery, just as descendant of rats was a piece of dwarfish malice. Deliberate insults to his size and feet, which he deeply resented.
Mm-hmm.
His feet, if conveniently clad and shod by nature, were as elegant as his long, clever fingers.
Mm.
So maybe they're a little long in that sense, right? I mean, if his fingers are long and clever, maybe the feet are a little longer and clever equally.
He doesn't say that. He just says his feet
were
elegant.
But he doesn't say it.
His fingers were elegant and his feet were elegant.
He doesn't say they're small. He doesn't say they're large.
Right.
And his frustration, his anger is more about the whole idea of rabbit.
Yeah, yeah. Deliberate insults to his size and feet, but he's not saying it's an insult to the size of his feet. It's just
probably
the hairy feet.
Right, exactly.
So, yeah, I think they have pretty normal-sized feet, and I think that
proportionally.
Tolkien's bit about elegant here and then the bit in the prologue about the Harfoots having nimble feet, I think it all suggests that hobbits have pretty much normal-sized feet for their size.
Yeah, yeah. Tolkien's illustrations really show that as well. Jim pointed out that, and we mentioned earlier, the one about the eagle in the eyrie with Bilbo visible. In that shot, in that illustration, I should say, Bilbo is wearing normal-sized boots.
That's right. So there's two pictures with Bilbo wearing boots.
Yeah, two pictures of Bilbo with normal-sized feet, proportionally-sized feet, yeah. So I think that's our answer. Not that it's going to satisfy people, but that's okay.
Right. Yeah. Okay, up next is Rafa.
Rafa, welcome to the show.
Hi, everyone. So I have a bit of a speculation question for you guys.
Sure.
So we know from the Silmarillion that Balrogs are actually Maiar, right?
That's correct, yeah.
Right.
Valaraukar, yeah.
Ah, yeah, that unpronounceable thing.
I know, I love that name. Yeah.
It's a great word.
And we also know that dragons are a product of Melkor, right?
Yeah.
So what do you guys think? Dragons can speak, can talk,
yeah,
and the Balrogs cannot, being the Balrogs from a higher power ranking, if you will.
Yeah, yeah. Arguably, certainly so.
Huh. Interesting.
That's an interesting point. I mean, certainly speech does denote, you know,
sentience,
intelligence, sentience, and the fact that the Balrogs are unable to. Though that may have more to do with the fact that they've really permanently chosen that form.
Let's be careful, though, because we only really see one Balrog.
That is true. Maybe they do speak.
In a dramatic, gosh, what's the word?
Yeah, in a confrontation.
Idiom,
in a, in your own particular
idiom, sir?
Idiom.
Yeah, we see a lot of Balrogs in the Silmarillion, but the Silmarillion rarely dips down to
dialogue.
A dialogue level, or, you know, like an in-the-moment narrative level. Most of it is just, you know, kind of that 10,000-foot view.
Mm-hmm.
The only Balrog we see is Durin's Bane. So I think we need to be careful about overgeneralizing that Durin's Bane is representative of all Balrogs.
That is a very good point.
In the case of Durin's Bane, the Balrog has been down there in Moria for thousands of years.
Yeah.
He hasn't had anyone to talk to. He hasn't had more. I'm not saying he needs a friend or anything.
Are you suggesting he's simply forgotten how to speak?
Yeah, I am. I am, actually. That's exactly what I'm suggesting. I'm suggesting that being deprived of Morgoth to give him orders and being down there for thousands of years with no creatures to communicate with. I mean, he's not going to talk to orcs.
No.
I think it is very possible that Durin's Bane has descended into kind of more of a feral state than, say, the rank and file Balrogs of Morgoth's army in the First Age.
That's a very good point. That is quite possible.
I can't prove it. I can't prove that the Balrogs of the First Age talk, but I'm about to look in the Silmarillion and see if maybe like Gothmog talks.
What do they talk about if they do? That's what I want to know.
Fire? Shadow?
Yeah.
I don't know. How awesome the Dark Lord is?
I have some really cool fire. Oh, that's awesome, man. I have some great shadow over here. Yeah, I think you're right. We can't assume that they never spoke or that they don't speak. But if they don't, why wouldn't they? My initial thought would be that if they don't speak, it's because they've really locked themselves into this form. They've given themselves this shape, and this shape doesn't speak. Its speech is not necessary for what they do. And just like we see with evil Maiar, that becomes permanent. They're not able to change their raiment. So it may just be a matter of that's the form they chose. As for dragons, I mean, you know, we talked about this, like, are the dragons maybe rogue Maiar spirits?
They could be. There's nothing to say they aren't. Yeah, we can't rule it out.
No, I can't rule that out. I mean, you know, Morgoth had Maiar in his retinue. I mean, obviously Sauron and obviously the Balrogs. So the question is, did he have other spirits, other Maiar that he was then able to manipulate? If not, you know, we've always talked about this. Where do these evil, terribly evil minds come from? Where does Glaurung come from and get this amazing power? You know, we don't know. We don't really have an answer for that.
Yeah.
Some incredibly powerful elf who refused the summons of Mandos, possibly?
It could be a little of all. I mean,
the
dragons must have multiplied after the manner of the children of Iluvatar.
Yes.
Right? Because Glaurung is the father of dragons.
Right.
So they're probably not all rogue Maiar or unclean spirits of Avari or anything.
Well, it's like Karkaroth, right? You know, I mean, who was his Draugluin, right?
Yeah,
We speculated that maybe Draugluin was a Maia spirit, but that Karkaroth wouldn't.
Karkaroth may have been just
a beast, a really hyper-intelligent beast.
Yeah, you know, just a child bred from that.
Right,
you know, which if Morgoth was breeding dragons, then...
Oh, man.
Then he could have somehow bred wild serpents into dragons and maybe found a way to put a spirit, either a Maia spirit or...
He's got a stockpile of evil Avari spirits who've refused the summons of Mandos, right?
Yeah.
Boy, this is interesting.
It is very interesting. I think dragons must at some point have had some unclean spirits put into them, like
the
earliest werewolves. So I do think that probably Glaurung at least had some sort of non-serpent spirit put into him from somewhere.
Yes. Yeah, I think so too.
Going back to Balrogs, I've looked in the Silmarillion and I've not found any instance of a Balrog speaking in the Silmarillion. But
yeah,
we do know that Gothmog was the Lord of Balrogs. He was actually the High Captain of Angband.
Oh, so he presumably was able to communicate then.
Must have been. You can't give orders if you can't talk. He must have at least had the sentience to communicate somehow. And even if he can't communicate in speech, hand signals or something, but...
Semaphore.
He's got to be sentient if he's a captain, so...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and even Durin's Bane, right? Gandalf puts the spell on the door, the command, the word of command to lock the door. And Gandalf talks about a counterspell, doesn't he?
Oh, that's true.
The Balrog casts a counterspell of some kind.
That's right.
And had perceived Gandalf.
Yeah.
So, once again, an indication of sentience, whether or not he has verbal speech, we don't know, but he has some sort of communication ability.
That's absolutely right. He definitely has intelligence, even if he is in a state where he cannot or chooses not to communicate.
You know, I just remembered something else, though. You mentioned Gothmog. We just read the passage not that long ago during Tolkien Reading Day about Húrin.
Mm-hmm.
Remember the end of that? After he's captured, Gothmog bound him and dragged him to Angband with mockery.
Oh.
How does one mock without some ability to speak? I mean, I guess he could have done mimes. He could have some sort of terrible pantomime, you know, like swinging with an axe and then falling over or something, you know. I mean,
really rude gestures with his fingers.
Yeah,
illustrating what your kids have been doing.
Oh, that's terrible. Or what they will do at that point. Yeah, you're right.
Oh, yeah, that's right. What they will do at that point.
So. Yeah, but yeah, he was mocking Húrin, so he's got to have something.
Yeah, I think so. I think either Durin's Bane can speak and doesn't. Or if he can't speak, he still has intelligence.
He's just forgotten how to talk.
He's just forgotten how to talk because he's been down there for so long.
10,000 years will give you such a crick in the neck and a total loss of speech.
Our first Aladdin reference of season 6.
Won't be our last, folks. I don't think it will be our last.
That is an amazing question though, Rafa. I really
like it. Oh, isn't it?
Yeah.
I love that.
That's
it's better than about Balrogs having wings. This is more fun.
Yeah, do Balrogs have speech? That's the question to be talking about, folks.
I know. Man, that's a good one. I love that. Jim, you've got something to pipe in on this one, right?
Yeah, a few of us in the comments are saying, could they be communicating by a Sanwe?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, just by thought. And so they don't find a need to speak, especially since they burn their tongues when they try.
That's quite possible. Yeah. Osanwe, certainly.
Yeah, I do think that is possible that they would communicate through Osanwe. I think that over time, I believe that Osanwe probably becomes harder for them because Tolkien's got a lot of stuff in the back of the Osanwe Kenta essay about how when Amaya spends a lot of time in a particular body and they spend a lot of time doing things like eating and drinking and procreating. I'm not suggesting the Balrogs do those things specifically. But
the things that tie them to Arda.
Right. Yeah. Those make it harder to exercise some of those higher functions. And I seem to remember speculating on the show before that the Balrog's corruption probably would have a similar limiting effect just because it is.
Oh, yeah.
They're just kind of steeped in the matter of Arda and they're just, yeah, you know, they're just literally in the muck. Of the filth of the world. And I tend to think that they probably would find their Osanwe weakened over time, but it's still possible. They may still possibly communicate with it.
It's still possible. And that could be how Sauron and the Balrog
might have
been able to communicate. You know, we've speculated about that. How would Sauron have gotten messages to the Balrog if he in fact did?
I do think that's very possible that Osanwe is a way they communicate.
I mean, I don't think you could mock Húrin through Osanwe. I think that has to be with actual out loud words, but
yeah, I think so.
But that's Gothmog, and he, of course, was the greater of the Balrogs.
He's
sure.
Smarter than the average Balrog.
That's a great yogi.
Thank you.
Hey, Morgoth, I don't let the ranger get to the Bicky Biscuits.
Hey, Baron.
Hey, Húrin,
you going to get the picnic basket?
Oh, man. We've got a whole slew of our audience who's just got to wonder what in the world
they have no idea
about.
What Yogi Bear is.
Yogi Bear, Boo Boo, and the Ranger. Just Google it, my friends. Please
the
do.
Ranger. Aragorn's the Ranger.
Aragorn is the Ranger.
There you go.
Indeed.
Durin's Bane is Yogi Bear. No, wait. Gothmog is Yogi Bear. I'm sorry.
Gothmog is Yogi Bear.
I guess forgot that what Balrog Durin's we were talking Bane... about there for a second.
Guess that makes Durin's Bane Boo Boo.
There you go. There you go. Right. Gothmog is Yogi. Man. Durin's Bane is Boo Boo.
There you go. That was fun.
This show just gets weirder and weirder with every season, I got to say.
Yes, it does get weirder. I wonder what it's going to be like in 4 or 5 years. After we finish the Lord of the Rings and we're working our way through, well, all the Legendarium extras, which will include, of course, a lot of the things from the Nature of Middle-earth. That's going to be so much fun.
Yeah.
It's going to be so weird.
It is.
Stick with us, folks. It's only going to
get
better.
I will trust the 4 people still listening at that point to make sure it's as fresh as it was way back in
Absolutely.
Season 6.
Absolutely. Well, Sean, I believe we have at least one more after Rafa before we get to at least a partial second round.
That is correct. We have one more for this first round, and that is Chad.
Oh, is this the famous Chad from Texas?
It is the very famous Chad from Texas. Chad from Texas, are you out there?
Welcome, sir.
The infamous Chad from Texas.
That's right.
You say so.
So my question is, I'm hoping that maybe it won't be completely speculation, but I fear that it's going to be. I was rereading again, as usual, and I noticed that during the 2509, when the Balkoth were invading Gondor, they were all gathering at the southern edge of Mirkwood, and Carion sent the messengers up to the Ithiad and asked Earl to come help. As they're coming down the west side of Mirkwood, as they get close to Dol Guldur, there's a shadow that's kind of spreading out from Dol Guldur, and as they see that, and they turn west away from it to get closer to the Anduin, and then there's another mist that comes from Dwemordine or Lorien, and it pushes the shadow from Mirkwood back, and then Barondir says, it looks like the Lady of the Golden Wood is on our side. So what I was thinking about on that is, how exactly does that work? Because you've got these two shadows, one coming from Dol Guldur and another one coming from Lorien. Just wondering if anybody had seen anything that explained that more than just this snippet.
Well, let's go ahead and read the passage in question and see if we can find any details to kind of hang our hats on. So first we get the assemblage of the host of Aeorl, in other words, the Aeothiad, and then we get them to set out. So let's see. At his right hand rode Barondir to serve as guide so far as he might, since he had lately passed through the lands. That, of course, would be the guy that was sent by Kirion. But this great host was not threatened or assailed during its long journey down the vales of Anduin. Such folk of good or evil kind as saw it approach fled out of its path for fear of its might and splendor. As it drew southward and passed by southern Mirkwood, below the great east bight, which was now infested by the Balchoth, still there was no sign of men, in force or in scouting parties, to bar their road or to spy upon their coming. In part, this was due to events unknown to them, which had come to pass since Barondir set out. But other powers also were at work, for when at last the host drew near to Dol Guldur, Eorl turned away westward for fear of the dark shadow and cloud that flowed out from it, and then he rode on within sight of Anduin. Many of the riders turned their eyes thither, half in fear and half in hope, to glimpse from afar the shimmer of the Dwemerdine, the perilous land that in legends of their people was said to shine like gold in the springtime. But now it seemed shrouded in a gleaming mist, and to their dismay the mist passed over the river and flowed over the land before them. And then they continue, Eorl basically says, ride on, we're not going to be held back by a river mist. And as they drew nearer, they saw that the white mist was driving back the glooms of Dol Guldur, and soon they passed into it, riding slowly at first and warily, but under its canopy all things were lit with a clear and shadowless light, while to left and right they were guarded, as it were, by white walls of secrecy. Man.
That's a great moment.
That is an amazing little moment, isn't it?
It is.
Then they get up the next day.
I haven't read this one in a long time.
At dawn of the third day, they rose from their rest, and the mist was gone, and they saw that they were far out in the open lands. So it essentially protected them from Dol Guldur as they journeyed. They were not spotted by the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Came there at a speed beyond hope. Ooh.
So, Chad, can you remind me what the question was here? Because now that I've looked again at the text, I'm trying to remember what the question was so we can answer it.
Yeah, it's just that I was imagining that more vividly than I have before. And I was just trying to remember if I've ever heard of any, if I've ever read of anything like that happening elsewhere. And the description of how this is going on, because I can see the shadow coming from Dol Guldur going west, and then an opposite mist that basically pushes it back like a tug of war almost.
Right.
A lit mist, a mist filled with light. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like the exact opposite. So I was just thinking if there was, if you guys had seen anything more on that, or if there's any speculation on how this was done from either side.
I tend to think that this is, because it's mist, and I was just listening again to the recent Questions After Nightfall where we were talking about the elemental powers of the three elven rings. And since this is an actual mist, I think this could be more of Galadriel's her magia enhanced by Nenya.
Yeah,
I think there's some water magia going on here. It's light, obviously, but we know that Galadriel, water and light, those are her things, right?
They are.
So I think that that's what's going on here. And I think that it may be that, I mean, like, we've never seen her do anything like this before.
No, but we know how aware she is. You know, one of the passages I was thinking about is early in Lothlorien. It's actually in the chapter called Lothlorien, before they meet the lady, before they meet Galadriel. Haldir is still escorting them along, and he's talking with Frodo, I think, at this point. And they're looking across the Anduin, and they can see this formless and vague land until, quote, far away, it rose again like a wall, dark and drear. The sun that lay on Lothlorien had no power to enlighten the shadow of that distant height. And then Haldir explains that that's southern Mirkwood. And he says, in the midst upon a stony height stands Dol Guldur, where long the hidden enemy had his dwelling. We fear that now it is inhabited again, and with power sevenfold. A black cloud lies often over it of late. In this high place, you may see the two powers that are opposed one to another, and ever they strive now in thought. But whereas the light perceives the very heart of the darkness, its own secret has not been discovered, not yet. So I think that kind of illustrates that same light versus dark, right? You've got the shadow and the bright mist.
Yeah.
That's definitely a link. Galadriel herself has something to say a little bit that maybe is a little harder to read when she's in the mirror of Galadriel and she sees that Frodo has seen the eye of Sauron. She says, I know what you saw, for that's also in my mind. And she says, I say to you, Frodo, that even as I speak to you, I perceive the Dark Lord and know his mind. So that harkens back to what Haldir said, right? That the light perceives the darkness, or all of his mind that concerns the elves, she says. And he gropes ever to see me in my thought, but still the door is closed. Again, echoing what Haldir said.
Right.
Then she lifted up her white arms and spread out her hands towards the east in a gesture of rejection and denial. If you look at a map, Barad-dûr and Mordor are pretty much almost due south. I mean, south-southeast.
South-southeast, really. Yeah.
Yeah. What is to the east?
Dol Guldur.
Dol Guldur.
Yeah.
I think she's talking about Dol Guldur at this point. So.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's very clear from these passages that there is this constant kind of tug of war between light and darkness, between Lorien and Dol Guldur.
Yeah.
And it's just it is a constant struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be that the reason we never see something like this, like something so overt where the glooms are spreading out of Mirkwood,
where it's a physical, tangible manifestation.
Right. Right. Almost like that unlight of Ungoliant almost.
Ooh, yeah.
And then so we see the lit mist spreading out from Lorien. We only see that here, but it could be that the only time that Galadriel does something like this is here because this is the only time that Sauron's forces have ever attempted to do something like this. You know,
that's right.
If Sauron's forces are going to spread their gloom openly into kind of the no man's land between them, then Galadriel's going to fight back.
She's going to respond
in a very open way.
Especially in a situation like that where protecting the Aotheod means saving Gondor.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because that's eventually what happens here. And you know she knows about that.
She's got to have the foresight.
She's got spies everywhere.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Lori, it looks like you've got a follow-up for us on that.
Well, yeah, just in addition to what you've already mentioned, I think that there's something else that we're supposed to be reminded of here with the light and the dark striving.
Uh-huh.
Is that I think we're kind of calling back to Doriath And remember that Galadriel spent a heck of a lot of time with Melian, right? And so Melian had the girdle of, you know, protecting Doriath from, you know, Utumno and the place where Ungoliant wound up living, who that I can never pronounce.
Yeah. Nandungortheb. Yeah.
Thank you. And
I do what I can.
You know, there's, I think in, you know, looking at kind of the roots and the foundations of Galadriel's power, we need to remember, you know, who she's learning all of this from. And so we're meant to,
that's a good
to
point.
Call back to that as well.
That's a very good point. Yeah, this is a girdle-like protection effect that Galadriel's is using here. Very much so.
Yeah, very much. Quite similar to that. And actively so, you know. I mean, this really repels the enemy.
Yeah, and I think enhanced by the ring, as we were saying earlier on.
Oh, of course,
we know
that
the ring enhances her natural magia.
Her magia is going to be strengthened by the ring.
Yeah.
Right. And that's, I think, the only way that she's been able to keep that door closed, as she says.
Right.
Mm-hmm. With that power is the only way that she can prevent Sauron from knowing more, from knowing her mind.
Right.
All right.
Great question, Chad. Thank you.
All right. Well, folks, we do have time for, I think, probably three more, maybe four if they're easy. And it looks like first up for round two is Jim. So, Jim, fire away.
Well, I'm not sure how easy it's going to be, but I was just wondering, are there any, because it's very complicated, Tolkien had a very complicated relationship with his orcs, what kind of beings they were, were they irredeemably evil and such. Like, is there ever an account of a rehabilitated orc or even an orc prisoner, or in the entire legendarium, is the only good orc a dead one?
To the best of my knowledge, there's nothing about a rehabilitated orc.
I'm not aware
about
an
orc prisoner. They are essentially cannon fodder, as Tom Shippey called them. And that's one of the things I think Tolkien really did struggle with in terms of, oh, well, you know, if that's the case, you know, are they redeemable? If they're elves, are they immortal? I think that's one of the reasons why he ended up late in his writings deciding that really they're going to have to probably come from men.
Yeah. Or something else.
Beasts, or something else. Because then, you know, how do you deal with the idea of an immortal Fea in an orc?
Even with men, you have a serious problem with the idea that corruption can be passed on from generation to generation, don't you? I mean, if Tolkien is telling us that what Ilúvatar has created, none of the Valar can change in its nature. So the Valar can't even make the Edain immortal to reward them for their actions in the First Age. Then how can it be that Morgoth can corrupt even a man so greatly that that corruption is then passed on, you know, from generation to generation?
Generationally, that it becomes an inherent thing.
Yeah, it becomes an inherent thing. It becomes part of its nature. I think that Tolkien struggled with all these questions.
Yeah, I think he did. I mean, it's a tough theological question in the real world. You know, you think about, I mean, from his perspective, of course, Tolkien would understand the concept of original sin and that, you know, with Adam's fall that, well, therefore all men are born into sin. That's sometimes a hard thing to swallow, you know, and I'm sure that was a thing that he had to grapple with in terms of his orcs, you know?
Yeah.
Especially since they didn't voluntarily fall necessarily.
Right.
The first time around, you know, I mean,
it wasn't necessarily their sin that corrupted them. They were imprisoned. They were lied
to. No, it was Morgoth that corrupted them externally. Yeah. So, you know, tough situation. I don't think that question can actually be answered because again, we even looking into the nature of orcs, whether they're descended from, you know, twisted elves or twisted men or twisted something else, are they immortal if they're elves? If they're men, do they get to leave Arda, you know, and do they get that gift the way men do?
Yeah.
None of those questions can be answered. It's all speculative.
No, but I think to answer the question Jim asked, I'm not aware of a single orc that's redeemed anywhere in the legendarium.
Not even in the extra legendarium stuff that I'm aware of. Nothing in the history of Middle Earth or anything like that.
No, and I think that if you read the stuff in Myths Transformed, which is that section of Morgoth's Ring where he talks about, you know, all these different, well, maybe orcs came from men, maybe orcs came from beasts, all these different ideas. What you see there is Tolkien kind of having realized he wrote himself into a corner and he wasn't really happy with the theological and metaphysical implications of the idea that the only good orc was a dead orc.
Yeah.
So
tough question.
Very.
Sorry, we couldn't do more for you on that one, Jim.
It's an interesting one. And I feel like, you know, it's one that we keep coming back to. But unfortunately, there just are no answers because Tolkien didn't have any.
No. And because his idea of their origins did keep changing.
Right. Yeah.
And
yeah.
that makes it really hard to nail down what might be.
Right.
Sean, did you say whether it was Lori or Diane next? I remember it was a close call.
My notes say Lori next.
All right, then. Lori, fire away.
All right. So we know that the followers or students of Aule include Saruman and Sauron and Feanor mm-hmm. and just the Noldor in general. Do you think Aule is ever sad that all of his students like just turned out to be awful?
Oh, man.
I think we need to remember that he had lots of students who didn't. Yes,
that's true.
Some of the high profile ones did. All the ones we hear about for the most part did.
That's true.
But that's why we hear about them, right? We hear about them because there's a story there. We don't hear about, well, we hear a little bit about Matan, don't we?
Yeah. The father of...
Of Neridanil.
Of Neridanil, right.
Yeah. I think he was probably very disappointed that so many of his students turned to evil.
Especially his top students. I mean,
especially
Feanor.
Some of his top ones. Yeah. Feanor is definitely one of the best. We know Sauron was one of the best.
Yeah.
Saruman was one that he must have trusted greatly in order to send him with the Istari.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm sure he was disappointed that some of his top students, you know, fell. But I dare say Aule was wise enough to recognize that he himself almost fell.
Yeah.
Over the matter of the dwarves. I mean, again, we've talked about this before. You know, I don't want to be too hard on Aule. His reasons for creating the dwarves were 180 degrees different from Sauron's fall or from Feanor's reasons for the things he did. He wasn't being selfish when he created the dwarves, but he did make a mistake. And I think he recognized that if he had not repented and if he had not atoned for the mistake he made, that he probably could have gone down the depths into being another Sauron or another Feanor.
Could have very easily gone down that road, recognizing immediately that what he did was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, confessing that he was wrong and seeking forgiveness and trying to right the wrong. That's what made it, that's what avoided the fall for him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's what we don't see in Feanor,
yeah.
in Sauron, and Saruman.
Yeah. But look, there are lots of great
students. Lots of students.
Lots of students.
Lots and lots of students.
But yeah, some of his stars definitely went down the wrong path. For sure.
Yeah, I'm sure he's very disappointed about that. I mean, they were all disappointed about Feanor. You think about that. You know, the Valar are gathered in the circle there, the Mahanaxar, and they're all talking about how great Feanor might have been had it not been for Morgoth. And yeah, all the great works he might have accomplished. They were heartbroken.
Yeah.
Because Feanor had so much potential.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So much wasted potential.
Yeah, it really is.
I wonder if it's, I always come back to this question of, you know, why is it always Aule's students? And I think it goes back to Tolkien's ideas about fall and mortality in the machine, specifically fall in the machine here. I think Tolkien recognized that sub-creative urge, which Aule represents more so even than the other Valar. They're all sub-creators, but Aule
they all are, right?
really is kind of the stand-in for sub-creation as a craftsman, as a linguist. And I think Tolkien recognized that sub-creative urge can lead to a kind of temptation that can spell your downfall. You know, what's the commandment? Love not too well the works of thy hand.
Boy, that is absolutely right.
Yep.
Yeah.
So I think that's why we see Aule's students turn to evil so frequently. And yeah, that's got to sting.
but it definitely stings.
I'm glad there's a lot of good ones out there too.
Yeah, a lot of good students. That's undoubtedly true. Ah, rough spot though. I mean, you know, wake up every day. Yeah, my best student just, you know, try to destroy the world.
Yep. Yep.
Bummer.
Got to feel a little bit like, you know, Yoda.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
it's
no,
like,
you're
aren't
right.
Hey, you're Yoda, right? Like, yes, you know, great Jedi Master am I. Like, wait, aren't you the one who taught Darth Vader? It's like, no, that was Obi-Wan.
His name was Anakin then.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's right. Obi-Wan taught him. It's not my fault.
Yeah.
Pin it on the young guy.
Exactly.
Well, Diane, I think you get the last question for tonight's episode.
Well, this isn't so much as a question. I'd like your input on something.
Fair enough.
I'm planning on getting a tattoo, and I'm working off of the Tolkien's Heraldry of the Elves.
Oh, wow.
And I'm just curious. Now, if you're going to put something on your body and it's going to stay there, you know, for the rest of your life, which one would you choose? And Sean, you can't say Arendelle, you have to pick something else.
Well, then I can't answer.
Oh, man. That's brilliant. I don't know, Sean. I suppose you can mention him if you really, really wanted to.
Obviously, everybody knows that my first choice is probably going to be Arendelle. Not just because he's Arendelle, but I actually think it's a really cool sigil with the six-pointed star and everything.
Yeah.
It's super cool. But if I were going to surprise everybody and not say Arendelle, I don't know. There's a couple of them that I really like that are kind of variations on that theme. I really like the heraldic device of Gil-galad. That's the one that's got a bunch of stars on it. It's not just, you know, the one star in the middle. It's got, I don't know how many, but it's got sort of a constellation of stars.
It's got the square. That's the blue and the gold one, right? With the
version I'm looking at right now isn't gold. It's blue and silver. And it's got a pattern of, I don't know, maybe I'm counting quickly, about maybe 16 different stars in it.
Oh, okay. Wow.
It's really cool. I love the star thing, obviously.
Yeah.
And I also really like the device of Thingol, which is, it's another diamond-shaped one, and it's got a white flower in it, but it's kind of a spiral design flower.
Oh, yeah.
With stars around it. I think that's a super cool one, too. I'm also a big fan of Luthien's devices that have flowers in them as well.
That's the one I was going to mention. That's okay. Such a lovely one.
It is a beautiful one. And they've got the kind of the white flower thing from Thingol's device, which makes sense. I don't know if I'd get that one on me if I were getting a tattoo. They're, you know, the flowers aren't necessarily my thing, but it's still a beautiful device. What about you, Alan?
Oh, man. I don't know. For the rest of my life? I mean, I got to have this thing on me for another 10 years?
10?
Well, you know. I'm not a young
Come on, man. Try harder than that.
No, I know. I'm teasing. I don't know. I honestly, if I'm getting a Tolkien tattoo, I think it's gonna be Aure and Tuluva.
Oh, we're talking words now. I thought we were just talking heraldic devices. Yeah.
I know but I can't I couldn't do one of the I love Luthien's, I love Gil-galad's, which is the one with the harp on it. I think that's a great one as well.
Oh, I can't remember. Oh, that's Finrod, I think.
That is Finrod. You're right. Of course it is. Of course it's Finrod. And it's a rude harp.
Of course.
It's a really rude harp.
Hey, what are you doing? Put me down.
Stop looking at me. You're staring. Look away.
Right.
Baron's is nice. The one with the single hand.
Too soon.
Way too soon. But I think if I'm going to get a tattoo, I'm not going to get one of the houses. I'm going to get Aure and Tuluva in script, you know, in the Tengwar. I mean, that for me, that's the moment. That's the thing. That's the thing that gets to my heart.
That's a good one. That's a popular tattoo, too. I actually know two people who have that tattoo already.
I'd have to find a way to make it custom and special, but that's what Jordan's for, right?
That's right. Yep.
Our producer, by the way, folks, is not just, and apparently we're giving him a free ad tonight. He's not just our producer extraordinaire. He's also a tremendous tattoo artist.
Yeah.
Well, he's not the actual tattooer.
But he designs tattoo art. Yeah.
Line art. It's really, really gorgeous stuff. So yeah, I couldn't do a house.
I hear you. I actually would probably go with words too. I've actually kicked around the idea of getting my kids' names translated into one of the Elvish languages and written in Tengwar.
Well, I guess I could do that already since Eleanor is actually already.
You got that one's, that one's already ready to go. Yeah.
Yeah.
The problem is that my son's name, Lucian, is kind of hard to translate. And the closest, well, it's not that hard to translate, but the closest translation I can actually find is basically Kalion, son of light.
Oh, yeah.
Which just happens to be the Quenya name of Ar-Pharazôn. So I'm not doing that.
Oh, no, you're not.
Yeah. So I'm not going to put Ar-Pharazôn's name on my body, even if it happens to translate my son's name.
Yeah. You have to find another way.
Yeah.
That was a fun question, though.
It was. It was super fun.
I don't know. The other one would be maybe the emblem of Aragorn's house, you know, the tree of Gondor, but with the seven stars.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one.
You know?
Yeah.
The banner.
Yeah.
The flag.
The Gondor banner. Yeah, for sure.
The Gondor banner. Yeah. But with the crown. Right.
Yeah.
All right. Oh, man, that was fun. Folks, that does wrap it up, though, for another episode of the Prancing Pony Podcast. But please be sure to join us again next week when we're going to finally get back to the text with an introduction to Book 4 of The Lord of the Rings.
Oh, and that, of course, means that we're going to spend some time looking back at, well, the last time we saw Frodo and Sam, which was Book 2.
Oh, wow. Yeah, long time ago.
Yeah, And we're going to spend some time looking ahead to some of the great moments and themes that we're really looking forward to getting into this season. So
yeah,
you're not going to want to miss that.
No.
Now, we do want to take a moment to thank the team that helps make this show better. That's our research assistants, as well as our Barlerman, Becca Davis, producer Jordan Rennells, social media manager Casey Hilsey, event and Patreon community coordinator Katie McKenna, and website guru Phil Dean.
Now, speaking of the website, please make sure to give it a visit over at theprancingponypodcast.com. We've got show notes, hilarious outtakes, Prancing Pony ponderings, as well as our online storefront where you can get all sorts of PPP merch.
And definitely check out our library page. You know we love the books here at the Prancing Pony Podcast, and we've provided links for you to get nearly every book we mention on the show. Now, we do get a few pennies from the purchases you make there, so thank you very much.
Indeed. And now we want to thank some more really important people, our patrons at the Kierdan's Contribution tier. I'm going to start with DeMay in Alaska, James in Virginia, Tamsin in Minnesota, Chad in Texas, Lance in New Jersey, Paul in Colorado, Jerry in Texas, Bruce in California, Mario in Utah, Seth in Texas, B in California, Joseph in Texas, and Kathy from North Carolina.
And then we have Lori from Washington, Josh in Oklahoma, Carlos in California, Brian from the UK, Cameron in Nevada, Ned from Connecticut, Jerry from Washington, Ryan from Alaska, Paul from Buckland, Joe in Washington, Erwin from the Netherlands, Hal from Washington, D.C., and June in Ireland. Thank you all so very much for your support.
Wow. Yeah.
And folks, please be sure you don't miss any episodes of the Prancing Pony Podcast. Subscribe to the show through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever your favorite podcast app is.
Mm-hmm. And one last thing, as always, don't forget to send your thoughts, comments, and, well, most of all, your clarifications, refutations, and argumentations about any of our answers tonight to Barlerman at theprancingponypodcast.com. And if you want a chance to have your actual voice heard, here's a new thing. You can send us audio of you asking your question by visiting podinbox.com/prancingponypod and record your question for us.
Just make sure to please still send the question to Barlerman, okay? That way we can make sure we try and get it on the show for you.
Yeah.
Now, Barlerman's a lot more reliable lately, but we do get a lot of mail, so we'll get to you as soon as we can, and your question or comment may be featured on a future episode.
As always, this has been far too short a time to spend among such excellent and admirable listeners. But until next time,
farewell, friends.